Last week we ended off at Rabbi Yehuda says, "Have you the Talmud Torah? Be very careful, because a mistake Talmud olezaton. If you make a mistake, there are no mistakes. There are no mistakes that are acceptable. God forbid, an airline pilot makes a mistake. Like you know, there are things that are just not acceptable. So we said that's impossible. Of course, we make mistakes in the study of Torah. We explained that." Torah is especially, it's a subjective field. It's not only objective. There's a lot of objectivity, but there's a lot of subjectivity. And the Rashi quote, Asher Nasi Yechta, Asher Nasi Yechta, which really means when, or when the Nasi, the leader, sins. And Rashi quotes Ashrei Ador, how wonderful is the generation where the leader sins and he admits his sin, because we discussed it's impossible for leaders not to sin. But we explained last week, I think, that the focus is on if he isn't careful enough, if he doesn't do 100% effort, then it's considered, then there are no excuses. And that's is the tension between, on the one hand, that's the tension Rav Moshe Feinstein describes in his introduction to Igrot Moshe, that on the one hand, who is he? What permission does he have to answer halachic like questions? And on the other hand, b'makom she'nish, like we learn in Perkevo, where there's nobody else, you have to do it. You have to step forward and take the role. As a matter of fact, we're coming up on Tisha B'Av. So the end of the story, the famous story of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa. So the Gemara that needs a whole shear, at least one whole shear. But at the end of the story, the Gemara has this funny expression or this weird expression, anvatunato, the anivut, the humility of Rav Zachariah ben Apkulis. That's the reason the temple was destroyed and we were exiled, not because of Kamsa, not because of Bar Kamsa and the rabbis and the whole story there, because Rav Zachariah ben Apkulis, if you recall the story, I'll quickly refresh your memories. He was the one when the rabbis realized that Bar Kamsa was up to no good. He was insulted, you know, they threw him out of the party for good reason. He was insulted and for good reason, he was angry at the rabbis. He had what to complain about. But still, to go to the Romans and say the Jews are causing a revolt, and the rabbis realized that they have a problem on their hand and they have to deal with it. So they had two options. They could accept the sacrifice that the rabbis, that the Romans had sent, that he, you know, had a little bit of a blemish that normally wouldn't be accepted. Okay, but to preserve the peace with the government, what we know from Pirkei Avot, it's so important, it's okay, we can let the korban. Or the option number two, the more severe option, is to kill him. He was like a moser. He wanted to harm the Jewish people. On both options, Rav Zachariah ben Apkulis said, no, we can't do that. Yomru, Shema Yom, people are going to say, all kinds of, you know, you can kill somebody for no reason, or you can bring improper sacrifices. Rav Zachariah ben Apkulis, and the Gemara has the expression, you know, Shema Yomru, what will people say? I find that a fascinating comment. When a politician, when a leader, forget a politician, that's what most politicians only care about, what people will say. But a true leader does what's right, not what people will say. It's nice. So what people will say, that's no good. And then, so the Maritz Chayetz, he's printed in the back of all the standard Talmuds. He's a fascinating character in his own right, really quite a unique individual, Galician, you know, great Talmud scholar, but a real independent thinker. So he has a fascinating comment. He says, why does the Gemara use the language, the anivut, the humility? So he says, because Rav Zachariah ben Apkulis felt, you know, who am I? I'm a nobody rabbi, right? Have you heard of him? Is he Rabbi Akiva? Is he Rabbi Meir? He's not, so you haven't heard of him. But he was the leader. He was the rabbi there. He was the most learned person. He was afraid. He was afraid to take a halachic stance. And because of that, the temple was destroyed. Hey. That's how the Gemara goes and presents it. So you see, there you see the opposite side, that a leader, a rabbi, has to issue a position, even if it's mistaken, that's normal. What our Mishnah was concerned about is when a person doesn't work hard. He's lazy a little bit, he doesn't pay attention too much, like the Gemara says, amazingly, by the students of Hillel and Shammai, the Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai. We discussed this last year. one approach to all the arguments of between Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai was Shaloshim Chu Rabbeim Kol Tzorcham. They didn't fully pay attention in class. They didn't fully get it. So Naseh Torah Kishtei Torah, and the Torah became like two. It's a very harsh criticism of the Beit Hillel and the Beit Shammai. The Gemara distinguishes between Hillel and Shammai, who almost never argued, and Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai, who always argued. And they, even though there are other Gemaras that say otherwise, and we discussed that last year, but anyways, you have this idea that if you don't pay attention, then terrible things, the Torah comes into. But otherwise, if you try your best, even if you're just, Rav Schari ben Akuz, you're not the most famous rabbi in the world. You're not the most learned rabbi in the world. It doesn't matter. Sometimes you're the one who has to make a decision. So that's the continuation, I guess, what we began last week, that a mistake in learning creates is considered like you are fully responsible. But then the Mishnah continues, and of course we always say, why is it in the same Mishnah? What in the world? It's a totally different topic. Rabbi Shimon Omer, Rabbi Shimon says, well, no, Mishnah Shloshik Tarim Heim, there are three crowns. There is Keter Torah, the crown of Torah, Keter Kahuna, the crown of a priesthood, and Keter Malchut, the crown of kingdom. And Rabbi Shimon says nothing about these crowns. He's not interested in these crowns. He's interested in the last part of the Mishnah. These crowns, so to speak, are discussed in the sixth and added chapter in Pirkei Avot. We know Pirkei Avot is only five chapters, but since the custom developed to learn it between Pesach and Shavuot, and there's 6 weeks, so they had a finagle. They had to do something to learn on the sixth week. So they had to make up something. So it's not so hard. We've got lots of material, lots of rabbinic material. So the beginning of the sixth parak, Shanu Chachamim Vilshon HaMishnah, our rabbis taught in the language of the Mishnah, and they quote other sayings, and it all has to relate to the receiving of the Torah, because this is the week before Shavuot. That's how the minhag developed, and we celebrate Shavuot as Matan Torah. So that's the chapter that talks about the beauty of Torah, the 48 ways of Torah. That Mishnah, how do you acquire the Keter Torah, the crown of Torah, the 48 ways to acquire Torah. So the Mishnah begins, there's the Keter Malchut and Keter Kahuna, and Keter Torah is greater because it's funny why the Mishnah there says that, but there it says the Keter, the Kohanim get 24 gifts. Truma, different gifts. You had to give Halach Zroa Keva Lechaim when you sacrifice an animal, or when you brought an animal, all kinds of different gifts are 24. The Malchut, the kingdom, has 30 laws, 30 hierarchies, and Torah has 48. There are 48 ways, and that's where the Mishnah discusses Keter Kahuna, Keter Malchut, and Keter Torah. Here, Rabbi Shimon's interest is, I think, is the contrast. He says there are three Ketarim. There's the Keter Torah, the Torah, Kahuna, and Malchut, and then he says, but. The Keter Shem Tov Oleh Gabeim, and the crown of a good name surpasses them all. Now, of course, his math is very poor. We're going to have to get there. I count four. There's Keter Kahuna, Keter Malchut, Keter Torah. The most important Keter is Keter Ker Shem Tov. So he begins the mission. There are three, and he answers four. So if anybody wants to chime in with an answer, that would be wonderful. We'll get there in a couple minutes or so. But he's not telling us, he's not interested in the crowns. He's interested in the crown of a good name. So that's just because what's the connection? What does that have to do with anything? What does this have to do with the beginning of the Mishnah that says, if you make a mistake in Torah, we don't view it as a mistake. If you didn't try hard enough, we're going to view it as a intentional sin. So you got to be very, very, very careful when you issue a trolling. So what's the connection between that and the crowns of Torah? So you could say, okay, the crown of Torah, not to make a mistake, a crown of whatever. It could be, I don't really think that's worked so well. I think perhaps, and this is maybe a little bit more radical or whatever, that what he's saying is that the mistake is when your Torah is disconnected from a good name. The purpose of learning Torah is to create a good name. And that's the famous Gemara that I like to quote very often, the Gemara in Yuma, page 86. We'll get there in Daf Yomi in a few days, where the Gemara says, "V'ahavta et Hashem Elokecha." You have to love your Lord, your God, with all your heart, with all your might, with all the soul. We say it, you know, at least twice a day. So what does Vahapta mean? So the Gemara says, that the name of God shall be beloved because of you. It doesn't mean you shall love God. It means you shall cause others to love God. Vahapta, V-E-E-Hapta, really, if the grammar that way. You should cause others to love God. And that's where the Gemara says that a person can learn Torah day and night, and but if they're not nice and they're not honest in their business dealings, people are going to hate Torah. Say, look, oy, 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 how terrible it is. This person learns Torah, his father taught him Torah, and he's not a nice person. But if a person has, quote unquote, a good name and people like him, people will come to learn Torah. So perhaps, and this unfortunately, I think maybe it's a modern interpretation, sometimes we live in a world where the majority of the Jewish people do not see, many of them are like Judaism and they're connected, but they don't see the overarching importance of Torah, of Talmud Torah, Keneged Kulam. It's the lifeline of the Jewish people. And that's, of course, then there are many Jews who bichlal don't have anything to do with Torah. But they express their Judaism in social justice and et cetera, which are very important ideas. So sometimes people who learn Torah lose sight of the fact, and there's such a disconnect, we can't relate to these people. Sometimes there are people look at people who keep Torah like they have nothing in common. And so what I'm arguing is that the role of somebody who learns Torah, it's an easy mistake. It's you're not intending that. You love Torah so much, you forget. Often people, experts like that, they don't realize what the common person is thinking. So perhaps, I don't know, this is my own idea, what the Mishnah is trying to teach us is that the mistake sometimes make in Torah is that you're not supposed to learn Torah for its own sake. Or Torah lishma doesn't mean to learn Torah, just to learn Torah. It means Torah to have an impression, to make the world a better place, to have an influence. So people will say, there's a Keter Shem Tov. The Keter Shem Tov. I don't know. If anybody has a better explanation, why these two teachings that better don't make a mistake in Torah, and then talking about the crown of Torah, and well, I don't know what that's with the crown of kingdom and the crown of the priesthood, are important, but the most important crown, of course, is the crown of a good name. So firstly, before we get to the four crown, you know, problems, there are four crowns, not three crowns. So we know that Torah is different from Malchut and Kuna. Well, that's what we're gonna see in a second. An interesting argument, but the kahuna and the malchut, of course, you're born into it. You know, you can't, the old joke, you know, my father was a Kohen, my grandfather was a Kohen. You can't become a Kohen. And you can't become a melech either. Som tasim melech a melech, and the halacha is melech is hereditary. It's not, we've discussed or mentioned in the past, I think last year, you know, Tzvi Grumet gave a shiur on four models of leadership. And he talked about, which is in Parsha Shoftim, we'll read in a few weeks. But the problem with hereditary, of course, is competence. Just because the father is great doesn't mean the son's going to be great. Chizkiyahu, one of our greatest kings, was the father of the worst king we ever had. Menashe, who ruled for 52 years. And the Gemara relates, Chizkiyahu didn't want to have any kids. That's also a fascinating Gemara. In Brachot, Chizkiyahu didn't want to have any kids. He was dying. He was dying young, and he didn't know what he did wrong. So God sent Yishayahu, a Navi, to tell him, why didn't you have kids? Well, what's wrong? The first mitzvah in the Torah, to have kids. Are you crazy? I have a vision. My son's going to be an awful child. Who wants to bring him into the world? So Yeshayahu says, "Bekivsei derachmana." I don't remember the exact expression. In the secrets of heaven, that's not for you. You have a mission in life to have kids. You don't have a mission to worry what the kids are going to. You try your best. All we can do is effort. Can try. So you have to have kids. So the greatness can be followed by awfulness, and that's the distinction between, you know, Aaron and Moshe. Aaron's had the merit that his kid, well, first Elazar, was appointed the Kohen Gadol. Then this week, of course, you know, Pinchas, the grandson who really gets the kahuna, established for his, what he did, well, that's a whole other discussion, but I guess the brit kahunat olam. So Aaron had the naches, had the grandchildren who were capable. Moshe, of course, did not. His children were basically nobodies and probably worse. We mentioned before, Pasuk and Shoftim seems to say pretty black and white. His grandchildren were involved in idolatry. So sometimes the greatest of the great can have, and sometimes it's Dafka because they're the greatest of the great. It's very hard when a person is such a public figure, often their family gets neglected. God told Moshe to neglect his family. That's the whole criticism of Miriam and Aaron. God told Moshe, leave your wife. We live with our spouses. Why can't you, Moshe? So God says, no, Moshe is different. So Taka, he neglected his family, and you see the results. But anyways, the kingdom and the kahuna are hereditary. There is certain value, and there's a stability there. There is something, you know, God's on. That's one type of leadership. By the way, the Navi, who's not mentioned here, he's a different type of a leader. And the Navi, of course, is not hereditary. The Navi is chosen by God for their special talents. So Torah is not hereditary. And that's the assumption. The fact that it is today much more than it used to be, I think, or sometimes it is, I don't know, it is a problem. It's not good. I think the Gemara says that why are the children of Talmidei Chachamim not Talmidei Chachamim? Why do you have great rabbis and great Torah scholars? Their children are can be nice people, nice businessmen. So you have that a lot. So the Gemara says people shouldn't think that Torah is an inheritance, just like the kahuna is an inheritance and the kingdom is inheritance. People think, yeah, what do you want from me? My father wasn't the rabbi. His father's a rabbi. Anybody who grew up as a rabbi's kid, as I did, you know, and so you know, there's certain expectations, fairly or unfairly, but I think I don't feel it really. I don't know Tova if she felt it at all. Tova was a wonderful student, unlike me. All the teachers say, are you Tova's brother? How can that be? How can your sister, who is an amazing student, fallen by me, the bum and everything? No, what can one do? But there are certain expectations. Your father's a rabbi. That's why he used to learn with you. And that's why you know what you know. So the Torah doesn't want that to happen. The Gemara says very often the children of Torah scholars are very ignorant. And I think you have that much more in the modern Orthodox world. You know, you look, many of the great rabbis and leaders who are there. I mean, Jonathan Sacks now, he comes from a very Pashtun family. His father was not at all learned. They weren't even fully Orthodox. You have a lot of that great leaders not coming from wonderful family, or, you know, learned family. So that's very important. So people shouldn't think Torah is a Yerusha. Anybody can get Torah. The Torah is Munach, and anybody can come and get it. So already the Mishnah doesn't make that distinction here. The Mishnah groups together Keter Kahuna, Keter Malchut, Keter Torah, and distinguishes it from Keter, the crown of a good name. But it is interesting, but we generally assume there is a distinction between Torah, that's available to all, and the Rambam writes that the mitzvah to learn is whether you're wealthy and whether you're poor and whether you're young and whether you're old and whether you're physically well or not so physically well. A person, everybody has the obligation to learn Torah. Torah is everybody. Torah tzivan lenu Moshe, Morasha kilat Yaakov, and Rav Soloveitchik points up beautifully in one of his, in Al HaTshuva, which we've discussed the book, the Chubich rushes, Atem Nitzavim Hayom Kolchem. You're all standing here as we're about to end the land of Israel. Chotvei Eitzim, the wood choppers and the water carriers, they're the same. You have nine men who are Moshe Rabbeinu, there's no minion. 10 men who are wood choppers, you do have a minion. But the wood choppers and the water carriers and everybody, they're part of the Torah community. The covenant was made with all. So that's the distinction. But I said the Mishnah doesn't make a distinction. So there's some who actually say, and it's, I think, of course, they are both true. Just have to, you know when. Keter Torah, it's also, not everybody can have the Keter Torah. The Keter is on the other hand. Everybody knows that Keter Malchut, Keter Kahuna, you can't have unless you're born into it. Of course, if you're born into it, you don't have to do anything. It's given to you. It's sort of meaningless. It can be meaningless. The Keter Torah, while you have to earn it on your own, but not everybody can earn it. because not everybody is gifted with a brilliant memory. You know, I always, sometimes they teach, you know, the Chafetz Chaim did this and this one did that, and, you know, or the Vilna Gaon. So, you know, I'm not the Vilna Gaon. I think sometimes these stories are harmful because if people feel they can't live up to expectations. If you talk too much about the stories of the Chafetz Chaim and what a tzaddik he was, and or the Vilna Gaon learning, you know, he put his feet in cold water so he wouldn't fall asleep so we could learn. You can learn 22 hours a day. And you tell that, you know, in your formative years, and that's the message of the yeshiva, that can be a very destructive, terrible message, because many people, not all, for some people it can be inspiring, but for many people it can say, you know, I'm a nobody, but you know what? No, you should have learned 22. You're not the Vilna Gaon. I don't expect you to do that. I don't want you to do that. You're not the Chafetz Chaim. The Keter Torah, you have to be gifted with a phenomenal IQ, you don't have whatever, all kinds of things. You have a you're not a social animal. You're not a sports fan. I don't know. You're not something that all the things we spend time on growing up. You become a gadol b'Torah. Although I had heard the story from in the name of Rabbi Hirschsprung, but people tell me now, I forget who they say the story in. Maybe the Repaleach, the Meitzer Eloi. The Meitzer Eloi was the one who Dov Rebel brought to Yeshiva University, the first true, true Gadol B'Yisrael, I think, in America. He came to America in the 1920s or so. Dr. Rebel at Yeshiva University, that was always, they brought over, they tried to offer jobs to great, great Torah scholars. The Meitzer Eloi was they called him the Meitzer Eloi because he was a super genius, the student of Reb Chaim. He died a young man, unfortunately, of a toothache. He got a tooth infection and he died. So they say the story, I know about him or Rabbi I had heard about Rabbi Hirschsprung in Montreal, who passed away not so long ago. Maybe people even here knew him, that they were such great Torah scholars that when they were children, they didn't let them play. You know, all the kids would go to recess and play, and they wouldn't let them play. You're going to be the next Gadol B'Yisrael, so you have to spend every single moment learning Torah. And apparently they said, both of them, it's true, it doesn't matter who it's about, all these stories, they don't have to be true. The story doesn't have to be literally true, it's just, you know, conceptually true, but it probably is literally true, that they said, you know, I would have been the same Torah scholar had I played a few minutes of ball also. It's healthy to play ball. You know, it doesn't take away. You can get a PhD at University of Berlin and still be the greatest Torah genius. You know, they say this, the Rav apparently told this story when the Rav Soloveitchik, you know, PhD in the neo-Kantian philosophy, and, you know, he wanted to do a PhD on Plato and the Rambam, but there was nobody in University of Berlin to oversee such a PhD, and, you know, he knew everything about modern thought and, you know, so many fields, so many disciplines, so they asked him, and yet you're the greatest scholar in the Talmud, the Dvar Avraham. When they gave Rav Soloveitchik, you know, Smicha, the Dvar Avraham Kahana, Kana Shapiro, the Rav Warsaw, who I think who was killed in the Warsaw Ghetto. I think that's the one who gave the Rav Smicha. The Rav was, 25 years old before he was coming to America. And he wrote that if all the rabbis in the world say A, if every rabbi in the world, there were plenty of great rabbis around that time. And Rabbi Soloveitchik says B, you do B. That's what he wrote in his smicha. So that's pretty unbelievable. So they asked the Rav, how did you become like this? when do you have time to do this? So he said, well, you were talking about me, wondering when I'm going to, how I learn all this stuff. That's when I studied philosophy. No, it's a cute line. But the idea is you can find time for everything. But we're not Rav Soloveitchik. We're not going to be Rav Soloveitchik. We're not Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. We don't have that brain. I don't know. Maybe somebody here does. So that's why some say the Keter Torah, just like the Keter Kahuna and the Keter Malchut, is not for everybody. No. This Mishnah, everybody can learn Torah, but the Keter Torah, the crown of Torah, that somebody can be the prince of Torah, you know, whatever, it's not hereditary necessarily, and we don't want it to be hereditary. It isn't good when you have five, you know, the Soloveitchik family, you had three generations in a row where the greatest Torah scholar probably was this, the Beis Halevi, Reb Chaim, Ramosha, the Rav, I don't know, maybe four generations in a row, the Brisker Rav, the genius, but that's an exception. You don't have that really. You're not, and we know there are many Rosh Hashivas that, remember Schneur Lyman once made a comment. I heard him once the comment that in Harvard, they don't appoint you based on who your father was. You don't become the Rosh Yeshiva of Harvard. You don't become a professor in Harvard because your father, you may get accepted to Harvard because your parents went to Harvard and the acceptance, but you don't become a professor at Harvard. And to become a Rosh Yeshiva just because you have the right name, sometimes they're worthy, sometimes they're in. Okay, that's whatever, however you want to apply it. But it is interesting, is the Keter Malchut, how the Keter Torah works. And I think this is really, both are true. Torah is available for everybody, but we have to know our limitations, and not everybody's going to be great in Torah, and that's fine. You shouldn't be, you shouldn't strive. That's a matter of fact, the debate, the Mishnah says, we're going to get to in a year or two or three or four, please God, and the fifth perek, it says that we have a life plan. So at the age of five, you learn Tanakh. And the age of 10, you learn Mishnah. And the age of 15, you learn Talmud. That's a biggie. Not supposed to learn like Talmud to the age of 15 for normal people. They don't follow that in our schools. The age of 18, you get married. Ben Shimon Esrei L'Chos. We don't follow that either, usually. At least the men, and that's who they're talking about. In the Hasidic circles, they do. But the Gemara has another opinion. That you get married at 20, not 18. Okay, then the Gemara has up to 22, whatever. So some of the commentaries explain, it's what's the issue? Get married at 15, get married at 18 or 20. Remember, people die younger, whatever. What's the issue? So someone who explained, the Gemara has a debate. How long does it take? How much effort should you put? You want to produce a Rav Moshe Feinstein. Okay, that's an exaggeration. But how long does it take? You know, you want to go to medical school. How many times do you have to apply and not get accepted till you realize, you know what, maybe medicine's not for me? How many times do you have to take organic chemistry and get a C plus and realize, you know, it's not for me? So the Gemara says either 3 years or 5 years. You have to, some people bloom a little later. So that's what someone explained. You learn Talmud. The Gemara assumes, and as on a certain level, it also requires more elucidation, that of course, when you get married, you can't spend the same amount of time learning. The most basic reason is because you have to work for a living. They didn't have this idea of a kolel, or you didn't have a rich father-in-law, a rich father, whatever. You went to work. That was the assumption of the Talmud. When you get married, you write in the ksuba, the husband writes, I'm going to support you from the on the eflach, ba'okir, ba'ezun, ba'farnes, yefi, lichi, kihilchut guvrayin, the way it's done, how men support their woman. It's against the ksuba for a wife to support her husband. The husband has to support the wife. That's what it says in the ksuba. Nunu. So some say, well, that's it. You get married at 50. You get married if it's three, you get married at 18. You know what? If he's going to become a super Torah scholar, you know what? We'll push off his wedding a little bit because you need those few years when you're single and you can learn 20 hours a day. You know, people are true must meet them. You know that. You know people like that. Maybe you've met them. People who are, I don't want to start naming names of the people I know who, when they were 18, 19, 20, were literally learning 18, 19 hours a day. They sat in yeshiva up till 2 o'clock in the morning, the first one in the morning, last one out at night. They didn't take breaks. You can't get married in that situation. You can't do that for your life, but you can do that 5, 6, 7, 8 years. So you do that till 24 and then you get married. So the Gemara is saying, for normal people, you get married 8:50. That's it. Time to go earn a living, and that's it. So where you shouldn't feel you're doing something wrong if you don't have the Keter Torah, perhaps. To learn Torah, yes, everybody's kovei eating the Torah. You're supposed to. That's the second question they asked you in Shemaim. Discussed last week. The first question, were your business dealings done to Emunah? Second question is, we're kovati eating the Torah. But the Keter Torah perhaps is reserved for only a few people. Okay, now let's get to the three crowns and the four crowns. I gave you a lot of time. He doesn't know how to count here. There are three crowns, Kahuna, Malchut, and Torah, and the crown of a good name supersedes them all. So there are four crowns, and the best crown is the crown of a good name. So why are there only three crowns? That's what I'm here for, no? Okay, anybody? No, Tova, you don't have any insights. I can pick on my sister. It's okay.
Well, it encompasses all three of them.
I'm sorry? Well, the idea they say is that if you don't have a Keter Shem Tov, if you don't have the Keter Tov, the prerequisite for Keter Shem Tov, for Keter Kahuna, Keter Malchut, and Keter Tor is a Shem Tov. Yeah, you can have a king who doesn't, then he's not really have the Keter of the kingship. He's just wearing it, but he doesn't really have it. So the Keter Shem Tov is the prerequisite for Keter Kahuna, Keter Torah, and Keter Malchut. That's why he doesn't say there are four crowns. I have four crowns. So I wear two crowns. I wear the crown of a Torah scholar and a Kohen, but I don't have such a good name. That cannot be. That cannot be. The Keter Shem Tov is the basis, so it's not counted as a separate crown. You want to discuss Keter Torah, be a real king, a real Kohen. A Kohen is supposed to be. Then first get the Keter Shem Tov. That's the most important, the prerequisite. Then we can discuss the other crowns. That's sort of like the view of the Abar Benel and others that, you know, belief in God is not one of the mitzvot in the Torah. You know, according to the Rambam, it's the primary mitzvah of the Torah. Yesod yesodot v'amud ha'amudot, the foundation of foundations is to know there's a God. Anochi Hashem Elokecha, the first of the Ten Commandments. But you notice Anochi isn't really a commandment. It's a statement. And the Bar Benel says, no, we don't count. It's not one of the 613 mitzvot. What is the guy going to say? You know what? I went through the whole Torah. I really love the Torah. But there's one thing I don't like about it. I like 612 mitzvot of the Torah. That mitzvah of belief in God, that's not for me. I don't believe in creed. Yeah, I like to give tzedakah, not to take revenge. I love Shabbat even. All these things. I don't believe in God. So that's, but I keep 612 of the 613 mitzvot. So that's insane. So, but in other words, you can't have the mitzvah to believe in God because every other mitzvah is dependent on that mitzvah. That's what some say. Of course, the Rambam. What does the Rambam do with that? So why does the Rambam say you do have to believe in God? When he thinks it's okay, I keep Shabbos, but I don't believe in God. What does that mean? For the Rambam, the mitzvah to believe in God doesn't mean to believe in God. It means to philosophize, be a philosopher. The Rambam, you know, that's the part they didn't like on the Rambam. They burnt his books. I mean, the Rambam, you know, philosophy, learning Gemara is small stuff. Is Havayat Davay Rebbe is a davar katan. Masa Merkaba, to study the ways of God, metaphysics and philosophy. Wow, that's what it means. So when the Rambam counts belief in God, it doesn't mean to believe in God that there's a creator. That, of course, is the foundational. The other mitzvot don't make sense, sort of, without them. Maybe they do, maybe they don't. Depends, I don't know. For sure, the mitzvot between man and God don't. But it's a mitzvah to do much more. But anyways, but here everybody agrees, I think. The Keter Shem Tov only makes the Keter Kahuna and the Keter Torah, most importantly, and the Keter Malchut, only makes sense, right? If you have a leader who doesn't have a good name, that's not good. The Keter Shem Tov is the basis of everything else that we do, just like belief in God. We have today, won't get into, you know, social orthodoxy. I don't really believe in God, but I like the mitzvot of Torah. No, it's also not so bad. We have that coming up also on Tisha B'Av, I think it's a pasuk in Yirmiyahu. No, I have to look and forget. Where does it go? Otita zovu vet mitzvotai tishmor. In other words, the Nabi says, forget about God. Who cares? I don't care what you think about God. Just do the mitzvot of the Torah. Just, you know, do what the Torah says. Belief in God can come later. There is sort of an idea like that. Just do what you have to do. Belief in God. I don't know. It's everything. But that's a whole, this again requires a whole different type of a discussion. There's interesting discussion in halacha about what about a person who does mitzvot, not because he thinks it's a mitzvah. He Taka really is an atheist. He really doesn't believe in God, but he greatly believes in doing many of the mitzvot of the Torah. He went to day school and he thinks the Torah is beautiful insights, you know, written by human beings, beautiful insights. So how does that impact mitzvot? The bottom line, we don't know, obviously. We don't really know, but there is a discussion, but there is a concept we have in rabbinic literature. Who cares if you believe in God? Just do the mitzvah. Just do what's right. And the truth of the matter, that's why the Gemara, in today's world, we are very much into, you know, what's his theological position and echveis, you know, orthoprax, and we don't care because he's not orthodox. And we might practice that. But in the Gemara, they only judge people on what they did. What you believed in, that was between you and God. First of all, how do we know what's in your mind? And, you know, people... It doesn't really, we can only measure people on what they do. That may be impacted on what they believe, but anyways, that's what we do. But the Keter Shem Tov is very good. And of course, just I'll say a few things that I think are rather obvious, but need to be said. That's having a good name is imitating God. Perhaps the key mitzvah of the Torah, of celebration, God always used to say, is to imitate God. Mahu rachum apatah rachum. The same way God is merciful, we're merciful. The same way God is kind, we're kind. That's what we say. The yud gimel mitzvah. So we have to emulate God in all we do. Whatever the Torah tells us about God is telling us about man. We can't understand anything about God. The maimadian view, right? So if the Torah tells us something about God, God is a creator. The Torah, we don't know how God created the world, but it teaches man must be a creator. Whatever the Torah tells us about God, that we're created in the image of God, we discussed last week how we treat other people reflects how we believe in God. If I believe in God, I'm going to treat you differently than if I don't believe in God, because I believe you're B'Tselem Elohim. So everything about God is really about us. We have to emulate God. That's the what we call the mitzvah of Kiddush Hashem and Chilul Hashem. That's what we call it. Chilul Hashem, to desecrate God's name. And the Rambam writes, this is the only mitzvah that you can't do tshuva for in this world. There is no tshuva for desecrating the name of God. Ki shem Hashem nikra lecha. It's all about having the name of God upon us. What does Avraham do? What do all the Avot do? Vayikra b'shem Hashem. Vayikra b'shem Hashem. We say on the stichas 500 times, you know, to call out in God's name. But Avraham, that's wherever we call out in God's name. And that's, of course, what Migdal Babel, that was the sin of Migdal Babel. That's the story right before Abraham. That's the contrast. That's chapter 11. I believe it's chapter 11 in Bereshit. They're all one. Which would be a great name for us. Look in the Parsha. They wanted to build for themselves a great name. And that's not our goal in life, to make ourselves great powers and great names. And it's to build for God. So in other words, right after the story of Migdal Babel, that's when we meet Avraham Avinu, because Avraham Avinu is the exact opposite. Avraham Avinu is building a name for God. That's what Rav Soloveitchik beautifully explained. There are 120 members in the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, the people who saved Judaism. We daven Shmoneh Esrei today because of the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah. We say Brachot because of them. We make Kiddush because of them. They set the patterns of Jewish life, the beginning of the Second Temple period, the beginning of Pirkei Avot. Without Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, we wouldn't be here. So how many people do you know who were in the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah? Name them. Name the people. You can put it in the chat box. Who do you know who is a member of the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah? You can't name more than five if you're really good. You're really good. And maybe some can name nobody. And we know, and because we don't, he says that historically, nobody ever wrote on biographies. This is a new genre. You know, Art Scroll has 5,000 biographies of great rabbis. And not only that, the academic research, Professor Chorsky, the Rav's son-in-law, did his PhD. He wrote his thesis on the Ravid, an academic dissertation on the Ravid. And Mark Shapiro did it on the Sri Dayesh. And last night's speaker, Rabbi Levine, did it on the Chacham Tzvi. These are academic biographies. It's the same idea as opposed to art schools. They don't claim to be academic. They're not meant to be academic biographies. This is a new genre. He says the normal way is that throughout history, we didn't write about biographies because it wasn't the people's didn't matter. It was their actions. As a matter of fact, the idea of a leader is to go into oblivion, that nobody should know who he is. Like he's important in his generation, and the next generation carries on. That's so against the way we think. We want to, you know, that's we want the legacy forever. But Rav Reis, in the Yom Kippur Machzor, they quote this from Rav Soloveitchik. We don't know who the members of the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah were, because that's the Jew works for God. And it's not important if you have a name, and you can be, being anonymous is great. And we know many people wrote books anonymously. It was not uncommon to write, anonymously. So that's, today that won't work, like whatever, you know, there is a reason the genre of rabbinic biographies has caught on today, because we live in a different society. But the goal is to make for God a name, not for make ourselves a name. And that's the contrast between the Migdal Babel and Avraham Avinu. So V'keter shem tov olel gabeim. Yes, of course, it's referring to our own name and how we live our life and how we're nice. And without a keter shem tov, you can't have the keter of Torah. But the keter shem tov is also a way to bring glory unto God's name. V'nikdashti, right? Kishem Hashem nikra alecha. Kishem Hashem akecha kra. How do we start the Shmon Esrei? It's all about the name of God. It's interesting. I was just thinking of that, of course, this past week. Shivasar b'tamu, so we read the most, I think, the most, you know, beautiful Haftorah of the year. Dushur Hashem b'matzokaru b'yotokarov. It's such a beautiful, beautiful Haftorah. Yishayahu Hanavi, and of course, the one of the psukim, v'natati lehem b'veiti b'chomotai, I will give for them in my house, in my home, in my walls of Yerushalayim, Yad Vashem. That's, of course, the origins of the name of the Holocaust regime, Yad Vashem. Tov mivanim umibanot, better than children, because it's talking about those who can't have children. Well, Imara Sariz, ni etzvaven, I can't have any children. So God says, it's okay you don't have any children. God doesn't bless everybody with children. I will give you a Yad Vashem. I will give you a hand and a name. Tov mivanim umibanot, greater than children. Shem olam eitenu, I'll give them a name, an everlasting name. The everlasting name, you know, is eitenu asher lo yikaret, that will never be cut off. And that's just an interesting notion of the concept of name. It's actually a very powerful, you know, pasuk. I don't know how many people think of it, but now, you know, whenever they read the pasuk, I think of Yad Vashem, and of course, it's such a beautiful, you know, name, and a tragic name, really, but a beautiful name to pick for the Holocaust memorial. But anyways, the Keter Shem Tov here, I think Rabbi Shulman is talking about us, but of course, everything else is about God. So that's okay. So that's Mishnah Keter Torah, Keter Kuna, Keter Malchut, whatever. And that whether we can all have the Keter Torah, I don't know. But whether we can all learn Torah, that we can for sure do. Okay. Then the next Mishnah, Rav Nehurai Omer, and perhaps what's the continuation? Maybe the way to get the Keter Torah. This is also it's fascinating. Hevi gole lemakom Torah. Exile yourself. Go galut to a place of Torah. Va'al tomar shehita v'acharecha, and do not say that Torah will come after you. You have to go after it. Shechavarchecha yikimuhu biyadecha, that your friends will keep it for you. They'll teach it to you. They'll do it for you. Va'al binatcha al tishen, and do not rely on your wisdom. Okay, so that's what the Mishnah says. So Rav Nehurai says you have to run away, be galut. You have to exile to a place of Torah. So before we discuss that, So first of all, there's a fascinating argument here between the Mefarshim and the Mishnah. Is this a good thing or a bad thing? Exile yourself to a place of Torah. Does that mean it's not so good? But if the only place to get Torah is to go to Israel, I don't have Torah in America, right? The only place I can go learn is somewhere else, 500 miles from my house. I live in Oshkosh. And they're nowhere to learn anymore. So I got to go learn. But it's nebuch. I'd prefer to stay home, but I have to be goleh. Galut is a negative term. I have to exile myself to Torah. So that's how the Bartanur explains. The Mishnah is not saying something good. The Mishnah is saying even if the only way to acquire Torah is to leave home and to go far away, you have to be heavy goleh. The Makam Torah, go into Galut. Yeah, it's a little bit exile, but that's the only way to get Torah. So that's the Bartanur. He says, really, it'd be better to stay home and to learn Torah. Well, why should you have to go to Galut to learn Torah? And the Tiferet Yisrael says, no. The Mishnah is saying, what are you talking about? To stay home. Gotta watch the Montreal Canadiens, the hockey game, you're at home, and the distractions and this and that. You want to learn Torah, you got to get away from it all. He says, tochacha megulai. It's very harsh language. This is an open rebuke to students who think they're going to grow in Torah. But you know, they come home for the weekend and they have the 4th of July barbecue, right? The 4th of Canada, they didn't, you know, was a muted affair on whatever for good reason in Canada. Those who are following the news, it was a very unusual Canada Day yesterday. But July 4th, nice barbecue, you know. He says, no, have you go there? Lumakom Torah. A person can only acquire greatness in Torah, and that's probably the connection between the prior Mishnah, the Keter Torah. You have to exile yourself to Torah. So that's I think that's a fascinating debate. I don't know what you think about it, and whose side you're on, so to speak. And like all these debates, I think both are true. Just depends on the person, the situation. Some people really do need to get away, and some people, it's not good to go away. And I think we often, people send away people at too young an age. It's also what days you go to. I mean, in Europe, the people learned in yeshiva, you know, the 1/100 of 1% was less than that. What do they have in Europe before the war? Maybe 20,000 people learning in yeshiva. Maybe. I doubt it. I doubt it was that high. In Valazhin, the greatest yeshiva, they had 400 people at its maximum today. There are, I don't know, 8,000 people learning in Lakewood, and I don't know, 10,000 in the Mir, and I don't know, in Ponovich. And it's like, you know, so many of those people really left home at a young age. They didn't have their cell phones with them, and travel wasn't like it is today. But Mamish, people like Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, these people, they left home at 11, 12. That's why some of them, their whole family became non-observant. They're the only observant person in their family. Sridi Geisha, Rav Aaron Cutler, his sister, most of these Gedolei Torah, who you all know about, most of their siblings were not observant. Because they left home, they were brilliant. They left, they went to Yeshiva, they went away from home. And you know, the modernity and the Haskalah and whatever swept their areas. Are you kidding? I don't have to go through all the names. I just mentioned a few of them. Most people rejected. They all had non-observing siblings, these people. So they were Golel, the Makom Torah, and they created greatness. They became great. Was that so good? I don't know. Maybe it wasn't so good, everything there, and leaving at a young age. So I think it really depends a lot. And I think the interesting sort of experiment today is the Israel phenomena, where, you know, every kid, and it's not exactly, but they're not going to Galut when they go to Israel, you know, with their cell phones and with their whatever. But the idea of leaving home to study in yeshiva, and I think we do see evidence that for some people, that's really was the only way they grew in Torah, was by leaving home, by it's the first time they're in an atmosphere of Torah. And I think maybe I'll get in trouble for saying this, but I think in many, not true for everybody, but in many cases, the impact on the Americans is much greater than on the Israelis. In other words, often an American in 18 will grow much more in Torah learning than an Israeli who comes from a yeshiva high school and goes to yeshiva in Israel, to even to a Hesed yeshiva. I don't want to, God forbid, you do see that the Americans get into it. You know, they come from America. Wow, it's the first time they've been exposed to it. For an Israeli, they're just really, you know, going sort of, and it's like us going to university. It's not such, maybe it is, maybe in America it's more, I don't know. It's not such a break for the Israelis going to yeshiva, where for the Canadians, Americans, the chutzart people go all to Israel for a year. Now, 2 years is much more common, way and way more people go for 2 years, some for more than 2 years. It's a totally transformative experience that I don't think the Israelis have. Is that always good? I don't know, but I think that's an interesting way, and there have been some research. Shalom Berger years ago, I believe that's what his PhD was on, the influence on the year in Israel. And I don't think there's quite enough research done. He already wrote his PhD a number of years ago. We need sort of a new, updated, more research. We've now had basically 50 years, more or less, since the on the Six-Day Wars, when this basically started, people going to Israel. There were some who went before, but not too many. So what the impact and how the religiosity grows and how does it compare for, you know, Israeli religious? That's a very idea, fascinating idea. But that's what the mission is. Have a goal at the Makom Torah. And I think the debate is unresolvable, and it should be unresolvable. And it depends on the person. For some people, this is an unfortunate type of a necessity, that the only way to grow in Torah is to leave home. And for other people, leaving home is not the way to grow in Torah. And you know, if you've got great Torah scholars here, why leave home? And whatever. I will say as sort of a well-known comment, if you really want to get the Keter Torah, now we're going to talk about the elite of the elite, the crown of the Torah, assuming, you know, that's only for the very few. So almost every person who got the Keter Torah did not have a traditional education. Rav Soloveitchik didn't get it. He learned with this. They didn't go to normal schools. Because great, every school, every yeshiva, even great yeshivas, even in Valazhin, Valazhin was a little bit different, but even many of the great yeshivas are I don't, constricting might be too harsh a word, but you know, they, you have to think, you know, with, there's a certain box in every educational institution. Mm-hmm. And, you know, kids who don't fit, we know that gifted kids often hate school because school's not for them. They're with normal kids. In Canada, we're cutting out all the gifted programs now. It's at least Vancouver, no more, Ontario just announced no more gifted programs in math. They used to have a, you know, in high school, the gifted kids went in, within the school, that the gifted math program and the regular math, no, can't have that anymore. It discriminates against other people, whatever you want to think about that, fine. So, greatness cannot, greatness needs its own program. And many of the great people, they learned on their own. They didn't go to schools. Everybody has their own experience because it was, had to be very personalized for them. Rabbi Soloveitchik became great because he was a genius, but he learned with his father 15 hours a day, or he heard his father give shiur. He didn't go to school. He was school. His mother arranged for tutors to learn gymnasium equivalent, what we would call a high school equivalency. Believe me, it wasn't the high school equivalency. I'm sure he was reading Aristotle. And I don't know what he was reading exactly, but more than we read in high school. And then he went to university, PhD, you know, as we discussed at the beginning. So that's an interesting argument. Heavy goal of the Makom Torah. Okay, so I just want to spend, and perhaps this will add a little bit, an aspect to this. Who was Rav Nehurai? Rav Nehurai Omer. So I mentioned last week, these Mishnayos, beginning last week with the Rabbi Elazar ben Shemua and Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Shimon, they're all students of Rabbi Akiva. We mentioned after the Hadrianic revolt, the persecutions, Bar Kokhba revolt, the rabbis realized that this is it. The temple is not going to be built very soon. I think Rabbi Akiva believed Bar Kokhba was the Mashiach, but the temple would be rebuilt. He made a mistake. And they told him the hair will be growing on your arm or something, and the Mashiach won't, you'll be long dead, and the Mashiach's not going to be here. The rabbis began to realize Mashiach's not coming next year. We want Mashiach now, you know, ain't going to work. The sin, that doesn't work that way. So they knew that. They knew we were going into a long exile. They had it. They could tell exactly. So it was time. It was time to change the style of Torah. They had to write down the oral Torah into the written Torah. And that's the students of Rabbi Akiva who began the process, completed 70 years later or so by Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi as the final editor. So we have all the teachings of Rabbi Akiva's students. So Rav Nehurai, I don't know who he is. Is he Rabbi Akiva's, like, you know, student? So there's one opinion. He's Rabbi Meir. Rav Nehurai, which makes sense. Nehurai is light. Meir, light, right? Nehurai. And the Gemara, the Gemara equates, the Gemara does say in one place, Rav Meir is Rav Nehurai. I mean, I'm not making this up. You know, that's one opinion, that this is Rav Meir and Rav Nehurai the same person. And it's just different, like a nickname, Nehurai. And the Gemara says, Shaman ir einecha chamin balacha. Nehurai comes, he made the light, he illuminated the path of halacha. We discussed once before, Rav Meir was illuminated beyond belief. The Gemara says he was such a brilliant genius, we can't follow his rulings. We didn't understand him. He could declare a sheretz, a rodent, pure 50 ways. By definition, a rodent is impure. But Rav Meir was so brilliant, he could explain to you why a rodent is pure. Of course, that's an impossibility, but he was so brilliant, nobody could get to the bottom of his reasoning. He was Meir, he like lit up the place. So some say Rav Meir is Rav Nehurai. The problem with that Gemara is that in the last Mishnah in Kiddushin, the Gemara quotes, that's the only time in Shas, mentioned this is one page in the 2,711 pages of the Talmud, where the Talmud discusses it, what profession you should have. We mentioned this before because the Torah couldn't care less what profession you have. Whatever profession you have, do it honestly, do it ethically, morally. Whatever, it's, you have to provide for your family, that's a mitzvah. So whatever your talents are, whatever you want to do, you want to be a lawyer, it doesn't matter, just do it right. The Torah doesn't tell you what to do. The Torah just says what you do, do it properly. So Rabbi Meir says, that's the famous mission, so the Rabbi Meir. Olam yelamed adam et, you know, umnat kala umnakia. We know that expression, clean, and how do you translate it? Light and clean. It's a whole other shir, what that means. Many of our professions don't feel it. Working 18 hours a day to make a lot of money, isn't umnot nikia v'kala. Of course, you have to work 18 hours a day to make enough money to pay for day school education. That's a whole other discussion. But you have an umnot kala v'nikia. You can learn and you can work, spend time with the family, you can support yourself. How that works, not so simple. That's Rabbi Meir. And Rabbi Nahu Rai says, no. Rabbi Nahu Rai say, I'm not going to teach my child anything. I'm just going to teach Torah. Because Torah, you know, in the real world, when you get sick, you don't make any money. They didn't have any sick pay. They didn't have any CERBs for those who live in Canada. They have a pandemic. I don't know what they helped in the States. It wasn't like in Canada. Here, people got at least $500 a week. Just the government sent you a check for $500 a week from anybody who lost their job or anything. Just gave, or the government, but I don't even know all the details of the program. At least $500. And then they gave billions of dollars to businesses and all the businesses that went bankrupt to keep the economy afloat. They didn't have that. So you're going to nebuch. But Torah, Torah keeps you, and even in old age, you'll be fertile in old age with the learning of the Torah. So I'm going to just teach my children Torah. So how can this be? How can Rav Meir and Rav Nurai be one and the same person? That's what some say. So I don't know. I don't think that's the question is so hard to answer either. Like everything in life, the two sides, because I'm only going to teach my son Torah. Rav Nurai was not advocating this for everybody. In other words, Rav Meir was giving a general proposition. Rav Meir, that was his comment. For most people, my own son, he's brilliant, whatever. My own children, I want them to be learned Torah all day. So that could be Rav Meir is Rav Nahum Rai, could be he isn't. So it could also be, this is my own thought, and we'll end with this, and we'll have to pick up next week, please God, that if we assume this Rav Nahum Rai, it says Rav Nahum Rai, and the Rav Nahum Rai in Kiddushin says, I'm going to teach only Torah. And we don't really follow Rav Nahum Rai. We only follow Rav Meir. The path maybe for the elite view. So you could say it's the same thing here. Habigola Lemakom Torah is not meant for everybody. It's only meant for an elite view. I said at the beginning, There's the debate. Because in other words, this Rav Nahum Rai is the Rav Nahum Rai who says, I'm only going to teach my kids Torah. I'm going to forget all the professions in the world. That's not for my son. My son is only Torah. So that's not the normative Jewish position. Perhaps it's a position for some people, but not for everybody. And not for, so it could be Rav Nahum Rai. It's that same Rav Nahum Rai saying here, for the unique person, it's that person sometimes has to go away. Rav Soloveitchik didn't go away. He dafka learned with his father. That's how he became great, right? So sometimes not. There's more than one path. Anyways, it's getting late, so let's just quickly review what we learned, that having a good name is what it's all about. More important than Torah, if you learn Torah and you forget, you have to, people have a good name, you have to connect. In our generations, it's so important, where so many don't see the value of Torah, yet they have to see that someone learns Torah, that's a wonderful person, and they're inspired. Shem Shammai Mitaheva Yadcha, the name of God, the shame tov that we have to give both to ourselves and to our God is beloved because of you. And the shame tov, the keter shame tov, is the prerequisite and the foundation of the kahuna, the malchut, and Torah. And whether, you know, on the one hand, Torah is available for everybody, but on the other hand, the really greatness in Torah, the keter, is not for everybody. And you have to recognize that. And that's why you go get married, live a normal life, and don't try to become the Vilna Gaon and the Chavetz Chaim. The famous, what's the story? The Hasidic story on Zusha, right? Wasn't that the famous story on Yom Kippur? He said he's not afraid when he gets to Shemaim. They're going to ask him, why weren't you like the villain? Why weren't you you? That's it. Why weren't you? So that's the most important thing. Having a Keter, Shem Tov, we can learn about the Ketarim in the sixth parak, and then how to learn Torah. Do you have to go into Galut, not go into Galut, and the different approaches? And rabbis can't be afraid to take difficult choices and decisions. Rav Skari ben Akulis refused to take a stand to let this sacrifice for the Romans. And the Gemara says it's not literally true. It's not the would have changed the course of history, but it doesn't matter. That's the Gemara's understanding. Often these little decisions do often have world effect. Maybe I should take that back. We know World War I started it. You know, they all start. There's often a little spark. There are many things there, but the little spark can send it all off. And sometimes you got to take that tough decision. And he was not willing to. Okay, any questions? I'm happy to answer. And okay. Questions, Mr. Zucker, I we won't leave until you can ask your
no,
your
so sorry. No questions, rather lots of questions.
Oh, no, you have to have, it's not the same. If there are no questions, I feel like I didn't teach properly.
I'll try to have two questions next time.
Okay. All right. You can think of one, if not anybody. But, okay, a Sunday, Rabbi Litak at 11 o'clock, we start our weekly schedule. Just to let you know, of course, I'm sure you should have seen we're having our medical ethics conference on July 11th. It's really a wonderful day, even if you're not a doctor. Many people come who are not doctors, we're doing it live. Wonderful day of learning. That's next Sunday. And of course, the Sunday after that, please God, we'll be having pretty much a full afternoon, 5-6 lectures on Tisha B'Av we'll be having. So, you know, watch your schedule for that. And as I mentioned last night briefly, Rabbi Ziering, Jonathan Ziering, who was, of course, the assistant Rosh Kollel here in Toronto, in the Beit Midrash, you know, Zichron Dov, will be starting a 5-part series on Torah and Shemitah and the rabbinic law. The upcoming year is a Shemitah year. And okay, we look forward to learning with you. And everybody be well. Have a Shabbat Shalom. And okay.
Rabbi, let me just echo what something you said. Rabbi said it's because of him that the temple was lost, because he refused to paskin on some, you know, what's his name again?
Right. The Gemara doesn't say what. Rabbi Zechariah ben Apkulos was the one who refused to let the Roman sacrifice be brought. So the Talmud kind of ends the story by saying his anivut, because of his humility, the temple was destroyed, the Jewish people were exiled. And I think there's a third thing they say. So the Gemara said, well, what's the connection? What did he do so terrible? He followed what Jewish law says. So you have to understand, sometimes you can't be so exacting in Jewish law. Jewish law has, except you have to look at the broader picture. A posek, that's a difference between a posek who is a computer, who looks at just the technical aspect, but you have to look at the broad aspect. I remember Rav Schechter often, I remember he once said, so, you know, he was talking on women leading, you know, create Hamigil, and he may have even been talking about for men, but for sure for other women. And I believe, if I remember correctly, Rav Schechter made the comment, it's such an important comment, the particulars are less important. The comment was, it could be true that in Hilchot Megillah, a woman can lay in the Megillah, maybe even for men in Hilchot Megillah. But you can't just paskin a shaila in Hilchot Megillah by looking at Hilchot Megillah. He said, you have to look at Kvod Tziv. You have to look at many broader aspects to paskin. So I sometimes use that in my own personal life. I hope I'm not saying something so terrible. Certain positions, let's say Rav Schechter, you know, who I learned so much from, that I don't agree with, I use the same argument in reverse. In other words, you can't. I'm a nobody. I'm not then any postseeker or anything. I'm just saying that you can't always look at a halachic question just at the question. You have to look at the broader implication. That's clear. If you study halacha, maybe that's surprising to some people, but if you study halacha and how psak works, and people, it's clear from the Gemara. Often other factors. So Rav Zechariah ben Apkulos was paskening based on Hilchot Korbanot. In Hilchot Korbanot, you cannot bring a korban that has a slit over its eye, right? But there's halachas of Shalom Malchut. There's halacha of Pichuach Nefesh. He didn't look at those halachas because he was too meek. That's how the Maritz Chayit says. He was humble. Isn't being humble good? The anivut, his humility destroyed the temple. I mean, he was unwilling to take a decision. Unlike Moshe Rabbeinu, who was humble, but he still was willing to break the lucha. Maybe he was wrong. Maybe he was right. But you can't be so humble that you won't make a decision. That's what I said. That's what Rav Moshe Feinstein writes in his Igra Moshe. Really, I'm a nobody. I mean, he's a nobody. But I shouldn't be. But you know what? You have to do it because there's somebody has to do it. And he's the one. He recognized he was the one. He was the one who had to take the responsibility, and he did, took some radical tshuvot. With the stroke of the pen, he freed hundreds of thousands of agunot. Right? He says, any woman who survived World War II can remarry. Ah, where's the evidence of her husband? We don't need evidence of her husband's dead. We have modern communications today. If the husband were alive, he'd get in contact with her. We know that's not 100% true. We know there are people who survived, people didn't know. Whatever. But Rav Moshe had the strength. Artificial insemination with the sperm of non-husband, that's okay. So they sent pigs to his house. So he didn't back down. You know, Rav Moshe was all the time. That's what a great posek does. You can't be humble. You can be humble in how you interact with people. You can't be humble in psak halacha. You have to be bold. All the great poskim were bold. That's what makes them great, great poskim. It's very, anybody can look up what it says in the Mishnah Berurah. I mean, anybody, you know. And you can look up, it says it's us, the Mishnah Berurah. You know, but the great poskim think beyond.
Yes, I feel the phrase halacha and meta halacha, you know.
Right. Now, how to apply it? It takes great, and the great people. That's not so simple. You're not, who's applying it. It's not simple. But that's the root of many of our debates today are rooted in these halachot, you know, and the big debates on meta issues, right? The much more than the technical aspects.
Thank you. Very interesting.
Thank you. Okay, anybody else? Zev, how are you? Nice to see you. I don't hear you. You are muted.
Sorry, I came late.
Oh, you're okay. Well, you didn't have to tell me. I wouldn't have known. That's a halachic issue. I remember Aaron Levine telling us. Let's say I make an appointment to meet you at 4 o'clock. And I show up at 4:15. I apologize. I'm sorry, I'm 15 minutes late. Now, you showed up at 4:12. So the question is, do you have to tell me? No, you didn't make me wait for 15 minutes. In Gnevas Das, I'm not allowed to deceive somebody. Is that a deception? No, halakhically, that's an interesting, or you have to say no, because, you deceive yourself. I didn't do anything. I'm not saying anything. Just keep your mouth shut. So anyway, so you didn't have to tell me you came late. I wouldn't have known. I give you full marks.
Now you tell me.
Now I know. I can't see when I teach. When I'm teaching, I can't see unless they're right in the screen in front of me. In case people don't know, I usually can't see who's there. Like when I come to classes, other people teach, so I can scroll through, see who's there. But when I'm teaching, I can't do that. I just have to focus.
Does this drasha go online?
Hopefully, I don't know if it'll be before Shabbos or in the beginning of next week. We have somebody who posts them automatically after every. So he doesn't, you know, he has another job. So I don't know if he gets, he knows, he usually gets them within 24 hours. And I told him the Thursday night Parsha Shir, it's very important to get up by Friday morning. But the Pirkei Avot Shir, I didn't make a big deal about, you know.
I'll catch it later.
Catch it later. All right. Have a good one.
Yes, good
shalom. Shabbat shalom, everybody. I'm sorry?